This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Daniel Thomas Moran, and he's the author of 6 works of poetry, most recently Looking for the Uncertain Past. Here is Daniel Thomas Moran.
This is called Saturday or Sunday Morning Early for my wife, Karen. This morning I left our bed early. You know how, with the early sun and silence, my mind begins to spin like that mysterious machine at the carnival which makes cotton candy. I try to not disturb you, but I imagine you alone, wandering in some storied forest with only the lights of a big moon to suggest your steps. Wherever you are, as our cats circle the room, stepping across clouds, I cannot be. Still, you always tell me when you know when I am gone. But I am never gone. That night which folded us together has more secrets to share with you, and I am awake in the company of many bushels of thoughts, conversations I will have, poems and letters needing to be written, and many things I placed on my nightstand just before I shut out the light and turned to cradle you in that rich velvet. This morning I am in your chair, playing out all the many cards of my life. The air, the piano, and our cats are all still, and I am listening, as I do, for you to call out in your sleepy voice and let me know that you have returned.
That's Dan Moran. He's come down from New York to see us, and he has been the poet laureate of Suffolk County in Long Island in New York, and today marks the end of that tenure, so we're kind of celebrating that with him. Of his work, a recent critic said, Moran's poetry talks with sardonic wit and sensitive spirit without sending us puzzling away from its lively clarities. Dan, why is it that critics see you in the light of William Carlos Williams, one of America's greatest poets?
Well, one of the reasons, I believe, is Williams was also a physician, and many people know that I'm a dentist, and so in that regard, we dealt with very similar things in our quote-unquote normal life. But Williams also tried very hard to talk about very finite things and to find the significance in small details, and I think that many of his poems are that way. And I think that even though there's a difference in the way my poetry sounds, I believe, from Williams, but our sensibility might be very, very similar.
Do you think you're in the American grain of tradition of our poetry, the modernists?
I think that I am, because I write pretty much what I feel. I'm not constrained by form or any rules that I subscribe to. So I write really what comes directly from my heart and try not to steer it too hard. And I think in that regard, certainly Whitman wrote in that tradition and people like Allen Ginsberg. And I think that that's part of the American tradition, is a sense of freedom.
I like that, not steering it too hard. He was born in New York City, and he is the author of several volumes of poetry. The last one, which we mentioned, Looking for the Uncertain Past, was published by Poetry Salzburg at the University of Salzburg in 2006. And Dan has read all over this country, and now you're going to London. Where have you been reading in Europe?
Well, I've read at the University of Rome, and I've read in Salzburg, and I've read in Graz, Austria. I've read at the University of Vienna, and I've also read several times in Ireland.
And do you feel you're a good ambassador for us?
I try to be.
And what do you think they know when you leave them? What do you think they know from your visit?
Well, it's interesting because people in Europe have a different sense of poetry than they do in this country. In this country, if I'm at a party and I'm introduced as a poet, people sort of look at me and take a half a step back because they're not sure what to make of it. But to show you the difference, my wife Karen and I were in the airport in Dublin and getting ready to fly back after I'd done some reading. So the woman that was giving us the seats asked if we had enjoyed our stay, and I said I had been there doing a couple of poetry readings. And she sort of took a deep breath and looked at my wife and said, "What is it like to be married to a poet?"
But now, I want to hear what McCarran said.
Well, she likes it very much, obviously. She follows me just about everywhere I go and is a wonderful partner and support. And I think she's barely missed any of the readings that I've done since we've been together. So I feel very fortunate to have her support.
And this is what it's like to sit opposite a poet. And so we would like to hear more from Dan Moran.
Well, this is a very short poem, and it's really about living in the country and my idea that it's better to not know the shortest, quickest way to get from one place to another. And it's called Traveling. Sometimes I take the long way home. to see what I have not been missing, to be nearer those things I can do without. I fulfill that need for distance and misspent time, semicircles in exchange for straight lines.
Beautiful.
I wrote that on the back of an envelope while I was driving the car, which is something that I don't encourage of younger students to be writing poetry while they're driving, but when the spirit moves me, I sometimes can't help myself.
In the back of cleaner's checks and
whatever was lying there, I started scribbling on.
Now we know that you are a true poet, as well as a doctor of dentistry. He got his undergraduate degree in biology. Is that typical for a doctor to get? Do you have to get it in biology?
You don't have to, but I think a lot do.
That's it.
Yeah, or chemistry possibly, basically, but frequently biology.
And that was Stony Brook University. And then he took his doctorate in dental surgery from Howard University. They have a fabulous dental school.
They really do, and it's one of the more historic schools in the country. I think it was actually founded in 1865, so has a very long tradition. And I was very proud to go there. I felt like I had a wonderful education.
Do you think that their methods tend to be more classic? More traditional,
well,
or is it?
It's possible, but I think also for a doctor to be trained in an area of, say, a poor neighborhood, which Howard University Hospital was in at the time, was very beneficial. I worked at DC General Hospital on rotations, and I got to see a lot of situations that people wouldn't normally see in, say, a suburban practice where I wound up in ultimately. So I got a great education. It was exposed to a lot of people.
That's a beautiful thing to call that an education when it was a great service.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. No, I felt that I was very well educated there, and it was a great privilege to be there. And there's a wonderful tradition at Howard that people's fathers and grandfathers graduated from the dental school there. And so you can really sense that there's a tremendous amount of pride.
Oh, that's really interesting. Being in Washington, we care about that.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Daniel Thomas Moran. And do not call him Daniel Patrick, which I did recently. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. He's appeared many, many places, not the least of which WNET in New York. Let's hear more.
This poem is called When Nothing Happens, and it actually was generated from a moment when I felt that I maybe wouldn't be able to write any more poems, which I think that every poet goes through. You always wonder where the next one's going to come from. They do come, but you have to develop a sense of faith about it eventually that they will without you thinking about it too hard. But this was about me thinking that I really wanted to write something and not knowing what I would write about. So it's called When Nothing Happens. I have stared out through this window before many times. Who knows the sums of such things? I was there this morning, a fresh mug of coffee, sending the aroma of waking up from the table beside me. Yesterday, the trees were the waving arms of children at a parade. The sunrise was a golden flood. In winter, the finches were the ghosts of spring, the frozen pond a tomb for the sky. The Christmas cactus was the ebon night above us on the 4th of July. And the hill which lifts this house fell away from the porch like the falter toward eternity. But on this day, the glass is only glass. The rain is only the rain. This morning is but the last of last night. The cats are just cats. The leaves of the laurel look as they do. And I am only a man in an old robe, cradling a cooled cup, capped pen in his pocket, and likely to be late for work.
That's a wonderful poem, A Tomb for the Sky. Yes, and it's also, is it the reversal of something you teach in that it's kind of a hidden joke if people know that you see the world metaphorically, and in this poem you say, but this time it is just the cats. It is just this. I am just in my robe. This is not a metaphor. This is how it feels to be alive.
Well, I've said to people when I teach that I think that artists see the world in gradations of color and shade and light, but when a poet looks at the world, he sees metaphors. And I had looked at this scene over and over again through the years, and then I started to wonder if I had actually wrung all of the metaphors out of that scene, but I found a few more despite that.
I like the old robe. You don't believe in sending a poem out into the world deaf, dumb, and blind. You fill it with fragrance, you fill it with sensibilities.
I try to give people a sense of experiencing what I was experiencing when I wrote it. And if I can do that, I feel like I've really accomplished something. Or to create an expression of something that's familiar to people, but they don't necessarily notice or pay attention to. maybe to remind them of something, that it was always there and that they were overlooking.
Nice.
So I try to look very deeply into things, and I hope that the poems then cause the reader or the listener to also look deeply into those things and sense what I felt emotionally when I reacted to that.
As a beginning poet, did you start with abstractions? I mean, were you kind of thinky in the beginning with ideas and more of an intellectual stance? I mean, because these are very rich in the sensual.
Well, I was very affected early on by the beat writers, and I think if there was something that made me really think that I really wanted to write was having read On the Road when I was a freshman in English composition in college. And I think that that sort of drove my desire and my sense of style to write the way that the Beats did. But I slowly got away from that and refined it and created my own voice. But in the very beginning, when I was writing things, probably as a teenager, a lot of it was about, you know, heartbreak and feeling isolated and all those sensibilities that adolescents go through. I went through that as well and wrote about that. So that was the source of the first bunch of things I wrote, which I would never show anybody at this point, but they do still exist.
Don't throw them away.
No, I haven't thrown them away. But
because you have your collection. I believe that your papers are at the State University of New York, Stony Brook.
They are in this special collections archive, and I'm very happy to do that. So I send them just about everything that I've saved. I've sent things to them that I did when I was in grammar school even. They're very thrilled to have that, but for some reason I'm somebody who's always been a collector, and I save every letter that has been sent to me over the years and articles from the newspaper and any number of things. And I was very happy that they were interested because I was
an alumnus
that they wanted them, you know.
Right. Oh, yes, you're an alumnus. Dan is at the Library of Congress. He's giving us his special day as the last day of his tenure as Poet Laureate of Suffolk County. I said that to somebody. They said, there's loads of Suffolk counties. I said, okay, Long Island. Here he is with a poem.
This one I wrote for my friend Samuel Menashe, who's a wonderful poet who's read at the Library of Congress several years ago. And he's also a linguist. And I think we can learn a lot about the way we look at the world by learning words from other languages. And what he was telling me was that the French word for the present or now is maintenant, and the significance of that when you break the word down, and it suggests in some ways how the French see certain concepts perhaps differently than Americans or Englishmen or Irishmen or Germans might. So this is called Translating Now for Samuel Menashe. Maintenant, from la main, the hand, wed to the verb tenir, to hold, becomes maintenant, that which one holds in one's hand. Not le passé, the past, that which is beyond our holding, nor l'avenir, the future, that which is beyond our grasping, but maintenant, the present, that which we hold in our hand, all we can ever hold in our hand.
Dan Moran is an anthologist and has put together a very important book with, I didn't realize we had that many fabulous poets in your area. Tell us about this anthology, which you edited.
Yeah, part of what I wanted to bring to the public with my laureate position was to sort of trumpet the incredible people who have lived in Suffolk County and on Long Island over the years, and in fact live there now. The east end of Long Island, in particular where I live, is very, very unusual because it's the place of birth of the abstract expressionist movement, and there also are many, many writers and artists there, and especially poets. And the thing that makes them unusual is many of them live in New York City part of the time and on the east end of Long Island part of the time. Many people know the east end of Long Island, or at least part of it, as the Hamptons, and places like East Hampton and the Springs and Sag Harbor is home to an awful lot of famous writers. And I wanted to create a historical document that would show who these people were, represent some of their work, put some biographical notes about them, and let people know that these fabulous people, who have some of them international reputations, in fact, live in Suffolk County. So I put the book together with that in mind and to create a document that would be preserved.
And what is the title of that book?
It's called The Light of City and Sea, which is sort of a suggestion of the fact that these writers write by the light of the city, but also the light of the sea, because the east end of Long Island is really sticking about 100 miles out into the Atlantic Ocean, you know, on the end of Long Island.
You actually are the one who chose the title.
Yes.
You imagined the title. Yes.
Yeah,
was that a difficult thing?
It was very strange. I bounced a number of things around in my head for a while, and then my wife and I were in Minneapolis visiting her family, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, I woke up out of a sound sleep and all of a sudden thought to myself, the light of city and sea, mm-hmm. that's what it should be called. And I bounced it off of a few people, some of whom were helping me in editing the book, and they said, oh, we think that's a perfect title. But it sort of just came to me almost in a dream, in a way, after a lot of thinking about possibilities. And I think it works to express exactly what I had in mind.
Well, may I say that you will be remembered for that book, and it will last longer than any of us, because it is a tough job to round up all those poems and to edit them and get it together. And it's got a lot of praise. That book has a lot of praise. And so do you. Let's have more poetry.
Thank you.
Daniel Moran.
This one is, I'm frequently asked by students especially, what's my favorite poem of the ones that I've written? And I always answer them, it's the one that I wrote yesterday, which really sounds a little flip, but it's not. Usually artists and writers are most fond of what they just did. But if there was one poem that I could suggest that I think I'm most proud of, it would be this one that I wrote for a friend named Bill Barksdale, who was a photographer who passed away about 15 years ago. It's called We Mortals. We long for the perfection in these things of the world, life certain in its bilateral symmetry, generations strung like pearls on imagined wire. We squint at the sun, we marvel at the plaintive syllables of songbirds, we admire tallness and clarity. Feeling the vibrations of it all beneath our feet, we rhapsodize distances suggested upon moonless nights, daring to name the ineffable. We write poems and chant to the mysteries. We dance round fires and the clearings we have made in the forest. We weep for the spirits of fallen trees. Facing death, we avert our eyes. When great things succumb, we tell ourselves they were never there. Thirsty, we lie on our backs, allowing our mouths to fill with rainwater, and hope to rise like blossoms from the dust.
I think that is actually my favorite poem in regard to music. That is the most lyrical of your poems, just having heard it twice. However, when I look at the lines on the page, they're so sure that one would think there would be more tension, and yet it just is quite a silky piece of work. Do you think it's the vowels, or what do you think is going on there, or is it the way you read it?
I don't know, maybe the way that I read it. I've said this for a long time, and I know it's troubling to some people occasionally, not that I expect it'll be troubling to you, but every poem that I write comes to me very quickly, and I find that when I get the idea and I get overwhelmed with this emotion or insight, that it's almost as fast as I can write the words down. And I probably wrote the bones of that poem in 15 or 20 minutes. So I'm not conscious of what's happening when I do it. I just do it. And I can tell when I look at it on the page whether I have something that I can actually turn into a finished product. But frequently, and I've even had this discussion with several friends who are poets, I'll say, this poem that you like so much is very close to the way that I wrote it the first time. And they'd say, oh, that's not possible. And then I will pull out the original copy, which I have, and I find that it's the only thing that I can rely on that I feel that really works for me is to write the thing without thinking about it too much in the great rush of emotion and insight and perception that I have. So I try not to think about it too much, and I find that afterward, if I try to fool with it too much, I stand as much of a chance of messing it up as I do to make it better. So it doesn't say that I don't edit. I edit a small amount, though, I would say.
Oh, I'm sure. But the honesty of your answer is the same honesty that shines through the poem, and that has been noted about you. And we were just at the Goethe Institute, where Dan Moran gave a public reading, and the people asked questions, and the way he answers is without pretense. I mean, this is the way it is. You know, this is the way I do it. And he has a lot of respect for his process, and that comes through. I mean, you don't dress it up. You don't say, well, you know, I had to do 50 revisions of this. You tell it like it is.
No, and I know many poets, very, very accomplished poets, write in a very specific way. They may get up, like I know William Stafford used to say that he got up at a certain time every morning. He sat at the same desk. He put his pen and coffee cup in the same place, and he sat there for 4 hours, and he wrote and tried to see if he could make something happen. I think Seamus Heaney was quoted recently as saying he spends 200 hours on each poem. It's unfathomable to me that that could be possible. But that's the way that he has found that works for him. And I think ultimately you have to be judged on the product and the way that it turns out. But I couldn't imagine spending 200 hours working on a poem. It's just not the way that it happens for me.
Think of all those patients in the waiting room.
Can you imagine?
It makes me so nervous. Dr. Dan Moran, he has been published in journals such as Confrontation, The Recorder, Nassau Review, Oxford, Poetry Salzburg Review, The New York Times, The Journal of the American Medical Association. Was that a medical poem?
It was. It was about somebody who was dying of cancer. And I was very proud of that because that winds up in a whole load of other journals as well. But this was the great connection for me in a spiritual sense between my medical side and my poetic side.
I agree.
And so to be recognized not only as a doctor but as a poet in the same place really felt especially satisfying. So I was very pleased with that. That just happened about, I don't know, maybe a year ago that was published.
We're at the Library of Congress, and we're going to hear more right now.
I had written this for my son, Gregory, who was very concerned that he wasn't going to be tall, and I reassured him by telling him that not only am I 6'5", but my father and my grandfather, my great-grandfather, were all 6 feet tall, so I kept trying to reassure him. But in having this conversation, I remembered what it felt like to hold him on my arm when he was just born and how tiny he was. And of course, I could recognize how much he had grown even if he hadn't. So I wrote this to him. And then I had another thought about how all this turns out, perhaps. And it's called To My Young Son. There was that day in October in a room familiar to no one, where your entirety rested on less than a forearm measure, my palm a cradle, my fingers expressed like new petals around your bud of face. Now you like to adorn yourself in my shirts and shoes, that old leather jacket you found in the deep of my closet. You want to stand back to back. I feel you slide against me as you lift your heels and reach to meet my shoulders. You cast your palm on mine and say many hopeful things. But I tell you to sleep well, to reach up without fearing. The day will be upon us soon when I will need to raise up my face to see into your eyes, when I will need to be reassured by your shoulders. Someday I will need to call out to you to come close and make of your hands a cradle for my head.
Critic Daniela Giuseppe says that his poems proceed naturally without contrivance. I think that's a good thing. He's a member of Pan American, and he was ordained a celebrant, I love that, by the American Humanist Association. Now, that means a lot to me because my background's in the humanities at NEH. But to be ordained into one, I want to be ordained. How do you do that?
Well, you can do that. Actually, the American Humanist Association has an application process. First, you would have to be a member of the organization, but they're looking for people to be able to provide rites of passage ceremonies like weddings and funerals and things like that for people who are not religious or possibly agnostic people or atheistic people. And they were looking for people who would be willing to, you know, be ordained to provide these ceremonies.
Have you ever done one?
I did one, yes. I'm going to do one in October. So it's very interesting to sort of play a preacher, you know, and I had people come up to me after the first wedding and say, Pastor, that was a very beautiful...
Would you have a title? You have to have a title, just doctor?
Yeah, I think so. But I'm very informal about that even. But, you know, people just didn't know who I was necessarily. I'm standing in front of 100 people, guests at a wedding, and I performed the wedding ceremony, and I knew the parents of the bride and groom, and I knew the bride and groom, of course, but nobody else knew who I was. I could have been the pastor from the local Presbyterian church or something. So it was sort of fun because I got to write something meaningful that was sort of poetic, or using what tools I had as a poet to make something beautiful and meaningful that would be memorable. And they were very happy, so I wrote a specific ceremony for them.
Are you going to do a different ceremony?
I'm going to talk to the bride and groom and see what it is that they want me to include, and then I'll probably incorporate that into this thing that I've written and maybe change it a little bit. Depends on how I feel, you know, right before that. But I'm sure that I'll work very hard to make something that'll be memorable for them.
Well, that's a new wrinkle I didn't know about you, and so that's go back to your poetry. Dan Moran, I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This one I wrote for my daughter Ashley when she was about 10 years old, and we had a very interesting moment sitting and watching one of my all-time favorite films, which is called Cinema Paradiso, and I wanted to talk about the fact that her mother and I were getting divorced at the time. This was in 1997. And reflecting on that and reflecting on the movie and her feelings, etc. So this is called Cinema Paradiso for Ashley. Flushed with the lights of this silver-coated evening, you content and perfect within the great cradle of my limbs, everything I possess of worth. I am holding you as an infant again, preserving the secret truth, how much my existence depends upon you, allowing you to need everything of me. We share the soft joys of a so sad film, you now of 10 years, closer to a woman than a babe, the stuff of you so much longer and fuller than realized, a silent singing in me to feel you weep at the melancholy, unable to ignore how unjustly soon my arms will be emptied of you, the sacrifice of all this to other arms, other rooms. You never noticed, never turned to see all those great sadnesses of my life spill from my eyes as if weightless, me the fool believing such moments are best unnoticed, how in this life no time can be spared to weep empty for what is gone, what can never be. The days take no pause, not even for little girls.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Daniel Thomas Moran. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back. That poem that we just heard about your daughter, that came from a wealth of feelings. Does she look at that poem now and comment on that? What does she feel about it?
Well, I think she's very moved by it. The situation is we sat and looked at this film, which I think is one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. I mean, the movie Cinema Paradiso I would recommend to anyone. It won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film, I think, in 1986. But I was watching it, and it's one of these things you just can't help but melt into because there's so much emotion. And she was sitting on my lap as we were watching it, and I was crying while I was watching it and trying not to let her know that I was crying. But then as the movie ended, she turned around and looked at me, and she was crying. And it was a very, very profound moment and something that has probably created a bond between us that, you know, I hope will last a lifetime, because I realized at that point that she understood a lot of things that I wasn't sure that she understood. So it was really, yeah, I think that she's very fond of that poem.
I think it's a privilege for the audience to hear the inner workings of what triggered a poem. And once again, your honesty shines through the poetry, and we want more.
I was saying to somebody recently that I find, because I try to write with such honesty and frankness, sometimes it's hard for me to read these things even years later, because it puts me right back in the place that I was in when I wrote it. And in that regard, as much as anything, I'm writing a personal history about the, you know, the points in my life that I found significant. And so it's, there are times when I really have a hard time getting through some of these poems because they were written with such emotion. And, you know, this was clearly one of them.
Stanley Kunitz says the same thing.
Does he?
Yeah, he did. He said that when he reads a poem, it's as if he is just living it. So you're in good company.
Oh, that is very good company. I hope I live as long as Stanley did, too.
That 100? Would be nice. Yes. Was it more than 100?
I think he was close to 101. I don't know if he was just shy of 101 or just a little past 101, but I would love to have a remarkably long life like that and a full one. This one, I don't write a lot of political poems, but this one is about the tragedy that's occurring still in Darfur in the Sudan and the genocide that's going on there and, of course, the enormous suffering. But I was very struck by a photograph that I saw. It might have been in the New York Times maybe about a year ago, and it was a picture of a mother holding her child who was clearly very emaciated and near death, and the mother was in the same condition. And I focused on one very, very fine point in that photograph that gave me the idea to write this poem. And that point was that there was actually a fly in the corner of the eye of the child. And that somehow took on the significance of the entire tragedy. And so this is a short poem. I don't write many short poems, but this is a short one called On Compassion. At Darfur, the children, weak from emptiness, accord the flies, the tears from their eyes. Neither dares ask mercy of the dust or the kings of the world.
I would love you to read that again.
On compassion. At Darfur, the children, weak from emptiness, accord the flies, the tears from their eyes. Neither dares ask mercy of the dust or the kings of the world.
I called you a poet of affirmation. Where is the affirmation in that poem?
I don't know. I suppose that there's, it suggests that there's a connectedness in life, and maybe there's some hope in it from that standpoint. But realizing that about the only thing that this child was able to give up anymore or give to life was a tear, and that the fly used the tear to continue its own life, I thought was a very profound thing. And it spoke about the entire tragedy in a very finite way, but I hope it had larger implications than that.
Well, that is what is said of you. It says, we catch our breath and grieve or laugh with the poet in unison with his compassionate self. And that is my husband's favorite poem.
Well, he's an astute listener of poetry, and I appreciate that.
It brings forth what you have often talked about, which is detail, that you want to focus on the tiniest of all things so that it ramifies. And so let's go on. This is from your latest book.
This is from the one just before that that's called From High Low to Willow Pond, which are two places on Shelter Island, on the east end of Long Island, where Karen and I live. And Willow Pond is where our house is at the moment. But this poem is sort of a New York City poem, and I think that there's nothing more important to New Yorkers generally than bagels. And on the east side in the Greenwich Village area, just up from Greenwich Village on the east side of Manhattan is First Avenue. There's a big place called Stuyvesant Town, which is a load of apartment buildings that were built after the war for the middle class. And many Jewish people, especially elderly Jewish people, live there, and they've lived there for many, many years. But there's a bagel shop there that's called Essa Bagel, which I understand in Yiddish means eat a bagel. And I used to go there and meet a friend of mine who I'd gone to college with, and we would have lunch. He was a resident at Cabrini Hospital, just a couple of blocks away. But it's a very unusual place, and I think that this is sort of a New York poem, and it's called Essa Bagel. We have surely been here before and many times in this brief enclosure where bagels are birthed all day and night, and not just any bagels, but thoroughbred bagels, crown jewel bagels, the bagels Abraham prophesied for the chosen people of Stuytown. Before its door, the great broad expanse of First Avenue rises gently toward Midtown, the forever of it rolling out from Hellgate to the South Seas. Yet in this place, everything is shoulder-width and no more, brown-topped table squares with a faithful hunch in quiet worship before tube lights in a chilled case of fish corpses and cheese. The little men in their Essa hats squeeze by again and again, dissecting sighs of steam from bagels' pursy flesh, opened like oysters to be smeared with delicacies beyond poetry. Taste and texture and kosher perfumes painting the dense air with life. You and I once more sitting, our knees meshed like primitive gears, we lunge forward and back, capture the overflow with each considered bite. With an ancient rhythm, we speak our prayers to wealth and abundance.
You might have noticed his broadcast voice. That's because Dan Moran hosted his own radio show. It was the Long Island Radio Magazine, and that was Long Island Public Radio. How far did they reach? Do you know where that radio reached into the city, do you think?
No, they had a choice. They got an upgrade in the wattage of the station, and I understand that the area that a broadcast station covers is elliptical. And they had a choice of going elliptically from east to west or elliptically from north to south. And they chose to go north to south, in part because the frequency it was on was sort of in competition with a very famous jazz station that came out of Newark. And also, the one half of their ellipse would have been out in the Atlantic Ocean, which would not have done them any good. So they chose something that actually went north and south. So the show was heard frequently, if the weather was right, in Boston, even though it was on the east end of Long Island.
Were there a lot of poets within reach, so you had no trouble?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was a very, the station in those days was very much arts-oriented, and I think that a lot of people loved listening to this sort of program. And they still have quite a bit of that going on, and also music and talk shows and things.
We're at the Library of Congress. We're listening to poetry.
This poem is called A Man Born of Heroes, which is really about my Irish ancestry. My great-grandfather, Thomas Moran, came from County Mayo in 1888 and landed in New York City. And I wanted to talk about the progress of my family through those generations. When he came with a hammer, and he was a stonemason, and also was apparently a jockey in Ireland. But he was not able to read. I don't think he was able to read his entire life, and so it was very special to me to think of the fact that after four generations that I had become a poet laureate and was writing poetry, something that many Irish people really have a great affection for. The Irish still believe that they own poetry, and I'm not going to be the one to argue with them, to be honest with you. So this is called A Man Born of Heroes. My father was a strain-hardened man, galvanized by years of train tracks and placards on roadsides which told him what to dream about. He believed in many things which never believed in him, bishops and board chairmen and saints and coaches, and souls which played somewhere behind the stars. He saw a world of square holes which demanded corners sharp and smooth, life a closet of gray suits and black wingtips, cleaned, pressed, and polished, ready for the next day and the next, hair never beyond the white collar snug about his neck. He came home each night, shoulders stooped with the island of Manhattan strapped to his back, and left again each day just as the constellations were dwindling into the distant sunrise. He followed his father, who carried a gold busman's watch in the fore pocket of his threadbare trousers, saved dimes for Dickens and the National Geographic, scanned maps for the lands of promise, and captained green buses along avenues paved with sweat and sorrows, measuring the moments until his debt to hardship was paid in full. The home on the quiet street, the car, the lawn, the rose bushes. And he had followed his father, who was a captain of fine steeds, banished from the sad counties of Erin for loving the jewels of justice by Victoria's brutal henchmen, tossed across the cruel shoulders of the North Atlantic to a brownstone in Harlem, where he hoped his God could recall mercy and his children could dare to imagine. And now myself, on another island, beside another sea, pouring out words great-grandfather could never fashion, without God or timepieces, embittered by our Pyrrhic victory, a thrall to a pen, and ever dreaming of Ireland.
Have you ever gone back to find your lineage?
I have, indeed. As a matter of fact, I stood in the doorway of a house that my great-great-grandfather was born in Sligo, which was really kind of a magical thing. I took my daughter Ashley there, and we met with a cousin who would have been descended from the part of the family that didn't leave Ireland, and I was descended from the part that did leave Ireland. And so this was a rejoining after 120 years in the doorway of this ruins of this house. And so it was really an incredibly poetic moment for me. We had to tramp through a pasture that was very muddy and everything to get there, and it was really quite a magical moment. What was even more magical was that the land was on the ocean in Sligo, and in those days that was the worst place to be because you couldn't grow anything near the water. And I walked out to the beach, which was strewn with shells, and when I looked to the right, which was to the north, I saw Ben Bulben, which is a precipice below which Yeats is buried. And there's a church called Drumcliff Church at the foot of Ben Bulben, which is just a great big cliff, actually. But when I looked at that, I said to my cousin, "Is that Ben Bulben?" And she said, "Yes." And I was, you know, you can imagine how I felt thinking that I was on the land that my great-grandmother was born on, and looking at Ben Bulben from there was really quite something.
As she did.
And it was amazing to me to think that she could have looked across that ocean and decided that things were better off over there than where she was, when she probably had never traveled more than a few miles from where she lived in her young life, and to decide to cross the ocean to some place she didn't know must have taken an enormous amount of courage.
I'm feeling that that's more of the writing you're going to be doing.
I think so. I've written some things about that, but I really, it's a spiritual sense for me to think of what these people went through. And I also have some Italian ancestors too from Stromboli near Sicily. And they did a similar thing. They came here almost completely blindly. As a matter of fact, my great-grandmother came here as part of an arranged marriage to marry my great-grandfather. So she was coming to America where she'd never been and about to marry a man who she'd never met.
Did it work out?
It worked out great, yes.
Maybe that's what we should go back to.
Yeah, maybe. They had 8 children and stayed married, you know, all their lives. But it's amazing to me that somebody could have had that sort of bravery, you know. Today, the kids don't want to go to the mall by themselves, is what it comes down to.
The thing I like is that you can occupy another person's psyche. So that I see a whole future of you occupying these people's emotional terrain and acting out what they might have felt. I can see a whole book of Daniel Thomas Moran's beginnings. But here he is.
Okay, this one is sort of a little bit on the humorous side. My wife Karen and I went to Paris on our honeymoon 5 years ago and went to do what you should really do in Paris, probably more than anything, go to see the Mona Lisa. And it's a very unusual experience, but this is about going to find the Mona Lisa, and it's called At the Louvre. I've been to see the Mona Lisa, traverse the angry Atlantique, dealt with Frenchmen, their lunging taxis, their coffee dense and bitter, their sweet condescension. I've stood for an hour in a wind-driven rain, descended into the great pyramid of I Am Pei, paid the fare in francs to wander that fortress past the winged victory, the armless Venus, Vermeer's astronomer, 500 depictions of the dying Jesus and the elegant portraits of many Frenchmen who would sadly lose their heads. I followed the signposts, heard my heels down the lengths of those long, hallowed halls. Then at once she was there, her face looking back at me over a field of cameras held high above the crowd, the subtle terra incognita of her, spattered with awe and battery light. And I took my turn, slithered and gaped and uttered excusez-moi, and then turned my back again and wandered off to look for Olympia, which was sort of the second generation of Mona Lisa, the Olympia by Manet, which was a gorgeous painting, was in a different museum, but that portrait had the same shocking significance that Da Vinci's portrait of Mona Lisa had before that. So, but I think I like the Olympia better.
Well, you'll be getting to see a little art in Washington today, maybe.
I hope so. It's wonderful to be back here.
We've got it to give. Dan Moran was the vice president of the Whitman Society?
Yeah, the Walt Whitman Birthplace Association. Walt Whitman was actually born in Suffolk County, which is part of why I decided to do this anthology, because I sort of saw him as the forefather of all these poets. And I decided that I wanted this tradition. I was the one that introduced the idea of a Long Island School of Poetry. And of course, it was easy to say that there was the first member of the Long Island School of Poetry being Whitman. But many of the poets who've lived there over the years have written about the city and also the countryside. And I decided that it would be good to start a reading series there that would bring in Long Island poets to read. And my wife and I got a plaque together, and she was on the board with me. And, you know, we would put emblazoned on the plaque the names of the poets who had come to read. And I was hoping it would be an ongoing thing, you know, for many, many years. So,
you know, this is laudable. We have to say, here's a man who's practicing dentistry. I mean, he has a practice, and he is establishing poetry readings. He is establishing, I looked on the internet, and I saw all the readings you had been giving, and they were, there was quite a list, a legion of them. You have visited almost every school that has, every school that's invited you from kindergarten.
Yes, I really haven't said no to anybody, but I think in the course of the 2 years of this tenure, that I will have done about 75 poetry readings in 2 years, which is a pretty extraordinary thing when you consider that all of my life before that, I was doing maybe 10 a year, which is pretty much what most poets would do, probably maybe even less than that. But I found myself sometimes doing 2 or 3 in a week, and I still in the month of April probably have another 9 or 10 readings before April is out. So, but it's been a great privilege to do that. And the idea that I can share something that I really love with other people and get them enthusiastic about it, I think is an important thing to do. And it's, I have a great sense of purpose about it.
Yes, you do.
But I feel I feel very grateful to have been given the ability to do something that means something to other people and to be able to share that with them and encourage them to do any kind of an artistic thing. There's something that I tell these kids all the time, and they're usually startled when I first say it, and then when I explain myself, it means a little bit more. But I said, if I were given a choice today of giving up my ability to write poems or to give up one of my hands, that I would give up one of my hands. Now, that sounds extreme, but that's how much writing is at the center of me. And what I tell these kids, even, you know, 10, 12, 14 years old, is that I really hope for them that they find something in their life that they feel that passionate about. I could survive with one hand, but I'm sure that I couldn't survive if I couldn't do this thing that I love so much. And, you know, I've probably written 1,000 poems in my life, and it's hard for me to imagine a life without that.
Which is, in fact, living a life which is larger than yourself. It's bigger than yourself.
Yeah,
and I think that would be very nice if everyone had that.
Yeah, I think that I said to them, you know, sing songs, play an instrument, draw pictures, do something, garden, do something that just makes you feel good to be alive, that isn't a job, that isn't something somebody's forcing you to do. Just do it for the love of it. And it doesn't matter what it is. And I try to encourage them to do that. It doesn't have to be poetry, though, but I'm happy if it is poetry, if they want to write poems.
And I know a lot of regional laureates who kvetch a lot. They say, oh, we have to do 9 readings a year, you know. Never have you done that. Never have you done that. You have embraced every single opportunity, and you've been indefatigable. And so we champion that in you.
Well, thank you.
And now we hear you.
Well, this is an interesting one. People occasionally ask me where poems come from, and sometimes they come from very strange places. But my wife, Karen, and I treated ourselves and spent 2 nights at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, which is, for those of you who don't know, a very famous hangout for poets in New York, of course, the Waldorf Astoria. But in any case, we went there to spend a night, and it was a very confused scene on Christmas Eve because a lot of people were coming and going, and the lobby there was full of people, and they have this big, beautiful golden clock that's in the middle of the lobby that everybody wants to have their picture taken in front of, and it chimes every hour. But listening to all the different languages and the people coming and going and the baggage and stuff, I thought that maybe, in a way, it was almost like people were waiting to get into heaven or something. And and when we got up to the room and a nice Spanish gentleman brought our bags up, I thought to myself that I had an interesting idea about who this gentleman might be. So this is called Christmas Eve at the Waldorf Astoria. Jesus brought our bags up to room 805 at a little after 3. He stayed only long enough to show us the minibar and how to manage the thermostat. He let us know that room service would bring whatever we desired around the clock. He was shorter than I might have imagined from those paintings of Caravaggio and all of the crucifixes of my childhood. Hair sable and newly cut, he wore a gray uniform like the others in his place, alive to serve mankind. The outer edge of his heels were burnished by the miles of pavement and carpet. I wanted to ask him about the war and the crying babies in East Harlem, the dripping glaciers, and where to find a thing like justice in a world turning itself inside out. I wanted to know if he could ever recall 63 degrees in New York City at the tail end of December. But I did not wish to add to his burden. The lobby was teeming with Italians and Minnesotans and French and Asians of many kinds, all staring up each time the chimes rolled out from that fabled golden clock. There was only time to press a folded 5 into his palm to thank him for bearing the weight for us who are travelers, and he smiled in a way which reassured me that somehow everything would be all right.
We get that feeling when we hear you read.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. There's a bookshop on St. Mark's Place in New York City that was a wonderful little place. It's now since moved to larger quarters, trying to compete with all the big chain stores, but it was a really fascinating old bookstore. One of these places that the shelves were, I don't know, like 6 or 8 shelves high, and there was one of these sliding wooden ladders that you had to get on if you wanted to climb up to the top. And in the beginning, when I first had my book published in 1991, the first book, I used to wander into bookshops where I knew it was in New York and see who was on the shelf next to me in the bookshop. It's a very strange compulsion, but one I've gotten over since. One of the reasons I've gotten over it is because the person next to me is always Marianne Moore, which is right next to me alphabetically. So this was about the experience of going into the bookshop on St. Mark's Place. It's called Lying with Marianne on St. Mark's Place. In the bookshop on St. Mark's Place, I'm lying with Marianne Moore, spine to spine beneath hard covers, shelved neatly for posterity by the motherly fingers of soft friends. She loves her men silent, and I love my ladies profound. There we lie, poised in our communal inspirations, naked musings and alliteration. Often in the padlocked midnight, I wait for her to turn and embrace me, but still she acts as though she never even knew me.
That's great. Another New Yorker, right?
I think she was a New Yorker, mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Cuddling up in the bookstore.
Yes.
Will you go back to the University of Salzburg Press for your next book?
I just might.
Mm-hmm. You like working with them.
I do. They're very, very professional. They really love what they're doing. And I think that they did a wonderful job on the book. I got some very good advice from them. And I was very pleased with the way things went. Being published in America, or anywhere, quite frankly, is not an easy thing. And publishing poetry is even more difficult, especially in the digital age, because there just isn't enough profit. Many things are published on the internet, and it's very easy to publish a handful of books. There are places now like Ex Libris where you can put a book together, and if you want just five copies, they'll print just five copies. Because of that, a lot of small presses are not willing to do a big printing of books because they know that they won't be carried in a lot of the bookstores. So you really have to sell poetry books by going out and sort of pounding the pavements in a way and doing readings and, you know, finding yourself in different places where people are interested in poetry. So I was very pleased that they were willing to do a book for me and happy in the way that it turned out. So I might, in fact, do that again. Yes.
Daniel Thomas Moran is his name, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. And it's my pleasure to sit here and be an audience of one. I love that personal transfusion that happens, and I want it again.
This one is sort of a funny little thing. I realize that I'm old enough now to remember when was only one blimp in America. It was the Goodyear blimp. And if you put on a golf tournament or a baseball game, you would see the Goodyear blimp shown hovering above it, taking photographs from the air. But now it seems like every company in America has a blimp, and it's always the Fuji blimp or the Chuck E. Cheese blimp or some other kind of blimp. But I'm not even sure I've seen the Goodyear blimp in a while. But it led me to a strange thought and the title of this poem, which is Someday We Will All Have a Blimp. Someday we will all have a blimp with our names in big letters on the sides if we'd like. We'll climb into our gondolas, keeping our grand nose into the breezes. We'll dream our dreams to the soft hums of our tiny propellers. We'll count all the swimming pools and scour the world for parades and ball games. The sun will make us squint even on cloudy days. We'll notice just how funny things look from way up there. And maybe one day our beautiful wives will come with us, bringing along our beautiful children, unless they all awaken that morning and decide it might be a better day to take out the submarine. I try very hard to believe that humor is important in poetry as just about anything else, and so I never hesitate to write something that I think is funny or is going to amuse people. This is sort of an odd one about an incident that I saw, a woman that had a friend, sort of a road rage incident with a woman that I knew. And I saw this road rage thing going on in front of me when I was going out to Southampton near where I live. And I was very surprised to see this friend who I knew who was a poet. So this is called At the Intersection of Poetry and Road Rage. Admittedly, the traffic was especially fierce, expressing into a funnel, conforming to a bottle's throat. The guy with the blue kayak tied to his roof racks was anxious to be paddling over some tranquil, silver estuary. The poet was feeling the great, terrible straining of creation, that undefined impulse which propels one toward beauty and truth. He didn't really cut her off. There was no intended malice from the gentle stranger, who merely hoped to share a common path. But he was in front now, and she held only one weapon, the horn on which she leaned with the entire weight of her life, and she did not release it. He performed a dance on his break, and she wound back and forth like a tiger inside the confinement of a dark cage at the zoo. He was unimpressed, sitting high up over his tall wheels, while out of her window she hurled great declamatory passages of profanity, and against that summer bug-strewn windshield she fired the most scandalous lines of blankest blank verse. Stick it up your clerihue, pal, and take that boat and ram it up your pantoum. Take this villanelle straight to Dante's hell. And he, always the type who was way less than impressed by poetry and by poets, took it all until it was all he could take, and then suddenly, without a warning, without a hint of foreshadowing, he turned left.
That is great. I love that one. Before we have a final poem, tell us what the Passwords Project is.
Well, when I was over in Austria, I met some people over there, very industrious and talented people, who decided to start a project that was going to marry words of poetry and visual arts. And they gathered together some writers. I think I'm the only American involved in the project. But I send them lines of my poetry that then get posted on their website. And artists from around the world who are participating will go on there and pull out lines that mean something to them and create a piece of computer art based upon, which are really extraordinarily beautiful, these things that people can do with computers, and do it based upon these lines. And you can see these things. So I'll get an email occasionally to say that's, you know, an artist in China has done an artwork over a few of my lines, and I can see what it looks like, and we write back and forth to one another. But they're going around trying to get this, to do exhibitions of this, and have had several things done around the world. And it's really sort of a wonderful international cooperation, not only with people from different countries, but people with different talents, some of whom are writers and some painters, some sculptors. And they've all learned how to do this computer art. And so it's been a great thrill. And to be able to do these things over the internet is really special. But the address of that, the internet address, is www.password.or.at. And you can sort of surf around that site and see all these beautiful things that have been done. So I think there are about 50 works of art that have been done using words from my poems.
Oh, I'm going to check it out.
Big
for
thrill
sure.
About that. Yeah.
And we will have a final poem.
Well, I'd like to finish with this because it's probably an appropriate one to read. And it's called Some Instructions. When my time comes, don't lay me in a box with long bronze handles. Don't comb my hair the way you always thought it should go and lay my head on satin. Don't polish my shoes or surround me with grand bouquets. Flowers die too soon. Don't embrace one another or blot the grief from your eyes. I will not have it. There should be no coffee, no cakes, no one singing Amazing Grace, and please no churches, no suggestions of the mysterious will of a God I deny. I am not going home, and I will not rest in peace. There can be no peace in extinction. Be certain that I did not go willingly, yet forego your misgivings. Act as you will, as you must. I will not raise up a single objection. Only be sure to have someone say that, given the chance, I would have stayed a bit longer.
The voice of Daniel Thomas Moran. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. The series is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry with assistance from Poets and Writers Magazine and The Word Works, presenting poetry programs in Washington, D.C. since 1975. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.